This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio broadcast and online streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this Sunday morning. And this morning our show will feature a conversation with Anton Troyer about a new version of his book, Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask, published for young readers. And Ashley Thornburg interviews Dakota Spotlight podcast creator and host James Woolner about a cold case involving a Williston teenager that is 40 years old today. First, a news update from Dave Thompson.
Governor Burgum has declared a statewide drought disaster. 70% of North Dakota is in extreme drought, up from 47% in the past week, with the remainder of the state in either severe or moderate drought. Burgum said for the second time in 5 years, state ranchers are facing widespread extremely dry conditions that threaten their herds and livelihoods. The governor said he and North Dakota Ag Commissioner Doug Goring have reactivated the Drought Disaster Livestock Water Supply Project Assistance Program. It provides eligible livestock producers with 50% cost-share assistance. That covers connections to rural water systems, new water wells, and several other sources to help livestock producers who face water shortages. The bonding bill is on its way to Governor Burgum. The Senate passed House Bill 1431 unanimously. It's back to the House level, $680 million. Senators did consider a $1.1 billion bill. Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson says Senate Appropriations Committee took a second look at it.
They felt that everything there was important, and that adding things would only gum up the process.
Wardner says it's exactly the same as the House passed it, meaning it will not have to be in a conference committee. He says such things as infrastructure for state buildings and $30 million for township roads are out of the bill. But Wardner says those projects will be funded some other way.
Some of the help is from the federal dollars that are coming. Wherever we can replace general fund dollars with the federal dollars that they match up and qualify, we're doing that. As a result, it frees up general fund dollars.
Still in the bonding bill, money for the FM diversion, the Mouse River Flood Control Project, and a new ag building on the NDSU campus. Wardner says he believes Governor Burgum is also on board with this. Governor Burgum has signed a measure to invest 20% of the future principal of the state's legacy fund within North Dakota. Right now, only about 1% is invested here. The bill calls for 10% in equity and 10% in fixed income.
Right now, I know of at least over $100 million worth of business deals that people are talking about, most possibly utilizing this bill.
Bismarck Republican Representative Mike Nathy is the bill's lead sponsor.
We did a financial run to see what the impact would be on the state. It's thousands of jobs, increase in GDP, increase in state income tax.
Nathy says a big barrier to business coming to North Dakota or expanding in North Dakota is a lack of seed capital. As part of the FM diversion project, a $67 million federal contract has been awarded to keep a stretch of I-29 above water south of Fargo. Industrial Builders of West Fargo was awarded the contract. It will raise the grade of the four-lane interstate above the 500-foot flood level once the diversion begins to operate. The announcement made by Senator John Hoeven.
We've got this really great, innovative way that we're going to do this. We're going to take the dirt out of the Red River Valley control structure where we have to excavate, and then we're going to use that as fill for the road raise, which is a twofer. It's a two for one. Because not only are we starting to dig the hole, so we're already starting to get the construction done on the control structure, we've got this fill now, so we don't have to go find and buy fill, because we can take the fill over and we can use it to raise 4 miles of I-29.
The grade raise runs between the Oxbow, Hickson, and Davenport interchanges on I-29. It's been more than 7 months since construction began on Amazon's massive fulfillment center north of Hector International Airport in Fargo. A union leader says progress is moving ahead at a rapid pace. Jason Ellert, the president of the North Dakota Building Trades Unions, says structural steel, precast walls, and roofing are nearing completion, and work is underway on pouring 1,300 yards of concrete each day for the interior floor. Ellert says there are about 150 union construction workers on site right now, and that does not include foremen and superintendents. The distribution center, being built on 110 acres of former farmland, is considered the largest building built in North Dakota. 19 football fields would fit inside. The company is planning to hire 500 full-time employees. For Main Street Weekend, I'm Dave Thompson.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Anton Troyer is an author and professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. A year ago, we talked about his work to preserve and revitalize the Ojibwe language. Today, you'll hear about an earlier book. In 2012, he wrote Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask for the Minnesota Historical Society Press. He's written a new version for young readers. Our conversation began with how this writing project started.
I could start first with how I stumbled into this project, and then the latest iteration with the Young Readers Edition. You know, I think by the time I'd finished high school, I actually went to public high school in Bemidji. And my goal was to get out of town and never come back. For some reason, I thought I was escaping the brambled racial borderland of my youth and kind of naively thought that it would be different in a different place. I got into Princeton University and I thought, oh, this will be great. You know, people will, be far more educated. And I think the first question was something like, hey, dude, where's your tomahawk or something like
that. Oh, man. Wow.
Thinking, these are the dumbest smart people I've ever met. But I had a great experience at college. And there's nothing like leaving home to make you want to come back and never leave. And so I was getting homesick. And at one point I heard there was a Comanche spiritual leader coming to the New Jersey woods near Princeton to run sweat lodge ceremonies. And I remember thinking, you know, there are weirdos and Fruit Loops out there. This could be one. The Comanche are from Oklahoma and Texas. What are they doing in New Jersey? But I was so homesick, I went to check it out. And it was about 4 in the afternoon, and there were about 20 white folk waiting for the sweat lodge ceremony, but they were all completely naked. And yeah, exactly. So part of me, of course, wanted to laugh because, dang, there's 20 naked people standing around in the woods. You know, part of me wanted to run because, dang, there's 20 naked people standing around in the woods. And part of me is getting mad, like, dang, is that what they think we're all about? And then, being naive, I get out of the car and I'm immediately folded into a tight embrace by one of these naked strangers who's hugging me and saying, I'm so sorry what my people did to your people. So now the feeling is like, word. And the desire to laugh, run, get mad is growing. And I looked at this person's face. She was an elder. There were tears welling up in her eyes. And it occurred to me, no matter how misguided she was, and she was misguided, that her emotional response was sincere. And if I just got mad and told her off, that would be her only experience with a native person. If I walked away, she'd keep thinking what she was thinking. So I had to think fast. And I said, you know, ma'am, could you put some clothes on? Because I would love to talk to you about all of this. And she did. And we actually had a good conversation. And in a weird way, you know, she learned some things, but in a weird way, I did too. You could say I learned something important from a naked stranger in the New Jersey woods, which is that it's important to make safe space, to give people a meaningful answer, not just an angry rebuke. And I started saving the questions, and they always came, you know, terminology. Is it Indian, Native American, Aboriginal, Indigenous, First Nation person, or what? What is tribal sovereignty? What's a naming ceremony? What do you think about mascots? You know, and I just started saving these questions and hunting for answers. I think as a Native person, I got the same sugar-coated version of Chris Columbus in the first Thanksgiving everyone else got too. And so while I knew what it was like living in my skin and having my experience as a Native person, speaking to, you know, Indigenous histories and cultures, that required some work. And so that was the, you know, genesis for the first book. And since then, it really took off. I routinely do about maybe 25 public speaking events a year, so a couple a month. And a lot of them have put me in front of young people. And so the goal with the Young Reader Edition is, first of all, just to speak directly to young people, our future leaders, who are bright and inquisitive and want to help make the world a better place. And also, frankly, since 2012, so much has happened. We had the Dakota Access Pipeline protest. We had that confrontation at the Lincoln Memorial, the Indigenous experience with COVID, lots of things that have really transformed the landscape in Indigenous communities. So the book grew, you know, in terms of the span of questions and topics covered, and I just rewrote everything to speak directly to young people.
Anton Troyer is the author of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. You can find out lots about his other books and about this issue, this book, at antontroyer.com. Troyer is spelled T-R-E-U-E-R. I was really intrigued by part of the title, Anton, Afraid to Ask. Is this sort of the cultural conflict point here? We want to know, but we're afraid of, you know, insulting somebody?
You know, sometimes it's difficult. Like, I feel like America's on the verge of another attempted racial reckoning. Certainly, you know, what has transpired with the death of George Floyd has galvanized attention about police practices with regard to people of color. And I think it's difficult for a lot of people in places like North Dakota and Minnesota and so forth to navigate this. We're trained to be so conflict averse that we almost become communication averse. We might get a new neighbor and drop off a casserole and then give them their space, you know? And it makes it difficult to lean in and really have important conversations and learning about some of the most important topics of our time. And so I think there is this kind of cultural training to avoid it. But avoiding it doesn't make it go away and it doesn't make things get better. So I do think there's some fear. People are afraid of exposing an ignorance or offending someone or things like that. And so the effort to make safe space, I think, is really critical. Ultimately, we're going to make things better when we can build bridges, connect with one another, learn from one another. Honestly, it's good advice if anyone ever wants to be in a marriage or have a kid or work in a workplace with more than two people as well. But especially if we want to tackle these big topics.
Well, let's talk about some of these big topics. I'll take one from the 2012 version for adults that you referenced in an earlier comment. What are the appropriate and inappropriate terms for talking about North America's first people?
Yeah, ultimately, we don't have universal agreement about terminology, which is frustrating and confusing sometimes. We've seen this happen in the Black community, too, where some people will insist on Black and others African-American, not colored people, but sometimes people of color in order to be more inclusive. And the same stuff has gone on in the Indigenous community, where some groups have doubled down on American Indian, like even the American Indian Movement or the National Congress of American Indians. Others, like the Native American Rights Fund, have said this is the preferred label. And it's confusing for everyone. So I think as a general rule of thumb for everybody listening today, you know, Native American and Indigenous are pretty politically correct. No one's going to get upset with you for using those, even though sometimes they're a little bit ambiguous. You know, if I say, you know, a Fargo Native, does that mean a Native American from Fargo or someone born and bred? So you end up having to use some more syllables to make it clear. I'd love for us to do what they did in Canada, where they had a big national conversation, and there they agreed on First Nation. So instead of reserves, they call them First Nations, and instead of Indians or Aboriginals, they call them First Nations people. And a couple syllables, everybody knows who you're talking about. It's clear, everyone can pronounce it. Perfect, you know, but we haven't gotten there yet. So I tend to use them all somewhat interchangeably, aware of their shortcomings as a means of making safe space. But if you happen to be working at a school or a program or an office and they're trying to figure out what to do, I usually say just engage the Indigenous people in your community, especially if you're at a school and there's a Native parent committee or something like that. There's a way to do that. And then if anybody gives you grief about the label you picked, you can say, well, our native stakeholders said to use this, and we'll take your comments. We revisit the conversation annually, and we'll take them into consideration when we have our next discussion. And it gets you a get out of getting beat up around the ears card, as well as a way to be responsive to your native community.
Another question from your adult version of this book, everything you wanted to know about Indians but were afraid to ask. You just referred to this. Do Indigenous people in Canada, First Nations, get treated better by their government than those in the U.S.?
It's just different. I wouldn't say anybody's got it better or worse. That, you know, in the United States, the status of tribes as sovereign nations is actually stronger than it is in Canada. But the difference is, you know, to be a sovereign nation recognized by the federal government in the United States, you have to have a treaty with the U.S. government. And a lot of tribes actually lost their land dealing with the French or the British or the Russians, as happened in Alaska and so forth. And they're not even considered legally recognized. In Canada, rather than an inherent sovereignty, you know, the status of tribes is something that's usually gone through the Canadian Parliament. But it really varies. You know, the Canadians had to deal with the French and the British and the Russians, but they didn't have to deal with a new colonial wave like in America with the Americans. And so I would say there's been colonization and oppression in both places. About 80% of the population in Canada lives within 50 miles of the U.S. border. A lot of people don't know that in the U.S. And so as you go further north, there are big chunks of territory where it's the population's primarily Indigenous. And so there's a little more strength of language and culture in some parts of Canada, but certainly not all. And right now, you know, I would say the Canadian government has engaged in a truth and reconciliation process that is kind of focused around Indigenous people brought to residential boarding schools and forced to endure a forced assimilation policy that was really devastating. And the Canadian government determined that the Canadian government had engaged in cultural genocide. So there's been an effort at reconciliation, but there are still huge issues in places like Canada. Even around, ironically, getting clean drinking water in tribal communities, even the ones that are sometimes quite isolated because of infrastructure developments and things like that. So I think the Canadian Indigenous people would not say we've got it better, you know, and I don't think the Americans would either. But at the same time, I think there has been progress in both places, and there's tons more to do in both.
From your new book, the version for young readers, a really intriguing question. What's it like for natives who don't look native?
Well, that is the case for a lot of people in Indigenous communities today. The native population actually has one of the highest rates of marriage to people outside of their racial group. And lots of native people may look white, look black, look brown, or look racially ambiguous. And so the experience really varies a bit. I think, you know, in dealing with the rest of the world, a lot of times people, you know, their first impression is based upon color. So sometimes we experience hypervisibility when we look brown or black. But then also we often experience invisibility if we don't look the stereotypical part. And a lot of, you know, like white passing Native people, Native Americans who look white, might sometimes be doubted in their authenticity by their own people, which can be another special kind of pain, and may be doubted by the rest of the world for their, you know, true indigeneity. So I would say the identity landscape and just the emotional fallout from that can be difficult and troubling. sometimes.
Anton Troyer is the author of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask, and we're talking about his new version of this book for young readers. The book was published for the rest of us in 2012, and there's a question that is posed in that original version of the book that's related to what we just talked about in the youth version. What is blood quantum? What is tribal enrollment? How are they related?
Right. So I would say every racial minority group has some sort of internal discussion about pedigree, and there's kind of a color line, and people get treated differently depending upon how dark they are and so forth. But it's further complicated in indigenous communities, because most of the tribes in the United States require that a person prove a percentage of blood that comes from that particular group in order to be eligible for citizenship as a member of the tribe. And that's the tribal enrollment. And so it's a hot button topic within indigenous communities, because in some places, you could even take somebody who's 100% genetically Native American, but if their four grandparents each came from four different Native communities, they might only be enrolled as 25%. And if they marry somebody, outside of that community, their children wouldn't even be eligible for tribal enrollment. So it's kind of an old genetics issue, kind of like Nazi science, really, designed to have us breed ourselves out of existence. And in my opinion, I think we should do away with blood quantum as the measure for tribal enrollment, but not everybody sees it that way. I think one of the concerns that some Native people have is if you open up, and have pick a different criteria for tribal enrollment, we'll be enrolling lots of people, who've lived outside of Native communities for a long time. Those political ideas will, overwhelm the agenda for tribes. There's competition for resources, even scholarship money and things like that. And so those are some of the fears they have. And I think that's easily enough mitigated by having a strong residency requirement for people who hold tribal office, or things like that. But ultimately, the politics of exclusion and people fighting to keep their grandkids off of the tribal rolls is just really unhealthy and sick. It is changing, and it's difficult to change because it involves constitutional reforms. And imagine how touchy Americans would be if we ripped up the Constitution and made a new one. it's like that for Indigenous people when it comes to restructuring tribal governments. But many of them have done it just this year, or just actually 2 years ago now. Red Lake changed their criteria for tribal enrollment and expanded their roles. There have actually been quite a few people who were added to the roles. Other places have done so as well. And I think that will be the pattern to move in that direction, but it is contested and it is complex.
From your young readers version, a question inquiring minds want to know, and this one is another good one. Why is it called a traditional Indian fry bread taco?
It's one of the great mysteries of the universe, Doug. Those words don't even sound like they should belong in the same sentence. But here's what it was, as at the start of the treaty period, in the middle of the 1800s, Native people were forced to consolidate their populations onto smaller portions of their land. And so there just wasn't as much. There just wasn't as much buffalo to access, wild rice to harvest. We had fewer resources. The government gave rations of lard and flour, and people figured out how to make food out of that. And you got fry bread. And it ultimately became something that people were used to eating, kind of culturally. And so, it's very common that there's fry bread served with, a Native meal really throughout the plains, the Great Lakes, even in the Southwest, and so forth. But it wouldn't be in any pre-contact Indigenous diet. And, I guess for myself, I can be a sucker for one of those fry bread tacos myself because they are yummy. But at the same time, with the highest rate of diabetes for any racial group in this country, we have to be really careful about what we center. And to me, I think decolonizing our diet and upholding our traditional foods, for example, things like wild rice, wild game that is, you know, smoked, roasted, or boiled rather than fried, you know, fish, berries, things like that, like it's all good for you. And it was just amazing when I was researching and writing for the Warrior Nation book, which is a history of Red Lake, how many people lived well into their 90s. Or Noden Wind, who lived, you know, was born in 1874 and dies in 1981. He was a grand marshal for the 4th of July parade in Bemidji and had lived through half of America's first 200 years, you know, and that was before smallpox, vaccines, and all of that, because people had healthy lifestyles and ate healthy foods. So I think without beating people up or shaming them for the fry that everybody's grandma cooks, you know, it's time to think about what is traditional in terms of our food.
Anton Troyer is the author of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. It was first released in 2012 by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. There's a new version for young readers. Anton is also a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. You can find out more about what he does and his books at antontroyer.com. Anton, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, Doug. Thanks so much for having me on. I always appreciate our conversations.
If you feel cooped up, cut off from friends, Americans a century ago were feeling the same way.
It is not that fun to be quarantined. It's not that fun to not be able to leave your homes. And so people are anxious to get back to regular life.
A history lesson in pandemics and human nature. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Monday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today is the 40th anniversary of the disappearance of Barbara Louise Cotton. She was 15 years old when she was last seen in Williston, and a police investigation failed to solve her mystery. She was 15 years old when she was last seen in Williston, and a police investigation failed to solve the mystery. James Woolner is the creator and host of the Dakota Spotlight podcast, and the Cotton case is the focus of his fifth season. This morning, we'll share a discussion about the cold case with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg, Woolner, and a childhood friend of Cotton's, Sandy Evanson.
Sandy, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
James, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Sandy, I want to start with you because so much of this centers on loss, and this person was your friend.
Yep.
What was Barbara like when you two were playing together in your childhood and early teens?
She was very quiet. She was very honest. She was very loyal. Mm-hmm. She was very pretty. She was fun. We would laugh and talk for hours. We'd spend all day together and never fight.
Mm-hmm.
She was just a very wonderful person. Just beautiful inside and out.
James, what drew you to the story of Barbara Louise Cotton's disappearance at just 15 years old?
It's kind of interesting. So it was on my radar maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I emailed a retired detective. He said, you know, because it is an ongoing case, he did not want to talk about it. But okay. He suggested I talk to the Williston PD, reached out to them, didn't get any response. And then I just put it on the back burner. And I went up to Williston, wasn't that long ago. It was the day I met Sandy in Recreation Park there. in January of this year. And I thought I was just going to maybe do a one episode thing, you know, and maybe even talk about a different case and just try to find Barbara's, you know, I'd read about her walking home. I didn't know anything about it. Kind of went up there to just do a little story. And between, you know, Sandy's interviews and, access to the family, interviews with Barbara's siblings, all of a sudden, it became much bigger than I expected. But I guess what drew me to it initially is it's just always, you know, a missing person, 40 years and very little information. I don't know. I guess I just wanted to try to find out as much as I could more about Barbara, I guess. I didn't have any thought that we're going to maybe try have any realistic chance of finding real answers. But once I got into it more, all of a sudden it just, you know, the community up there just come out of the woodwork and people want answers.
Yeah, four decades of little information that she's never been found or heard from again since April of 1981. Sandy, as someone who lost a dear friend in a very, very tender age, and then 40 years goes by, and I'm wondering, how do you keep up, I don't know if hope is the right word. I guess I should start with that. Do you keep up hope that you will still find Barbara alive?
No, not alive.
So what are you hoping for at this point?
We find her and bring her home. That is one thing I'd really love to do, but that one's even hard to keep hope after 40 years. Barb would have came home if she's alive. A couple people have made the suggestion, you know, what if she had amnesia and that'd be the only way that I could ever see it happening. She would never have been gone from her family or her friends without no call this long. And as you probably recall, that she was supposed to be in a wedding with Diane Lattiser. Mm-hmm. And she would have never left Diane. That's not the kind of person Barb was. She would have never left her hanging like that.
Yeah.
So hope that she's alive, not so much. Not at all, really. And I felt that early on. I can remember feeling that early on, that this was bad. And that she wasn't a runaway. And that she probably wasn't coming home in a good way.
Yeah. In the podcast, you talk about people who put out this theory that, you know, she's 15 years old, she's fighting with her mom, there might be a boyfriend who travels a lot, and people do put out the idea that she's a runaway, and you never thought that.
I feel like that came from the police department, you know, more than anything, but Louise seeing them together that night, like that's her first tip. And a lot of people get stuck on the word boyfriend, but at that time we would say boyfriend for just a friend that was a boy. And so, but then he's the last person, so did Barb just take off with him and you know, had plans on coming home the next night or something, is what Louise is thinking. And then now she's too scared to. And so she's given the police these tips and that, you know, that's kind of the thought that I get from what I remember of Louise telling me and also telling my mom about that incident.
James, you said right away that you thought you might do one episode on Barbara Louise Cotton, and then early on in the podcast, you call it a five-part series. At the time of this recording, and we're talking on Saturday, I think it's March 27th, yes, at the time of this recording, there are 8 episodes, and it ends on a bit of a cliffhanger and a promise for more, and before we started recording, you said you have enough for at least one more, maybe even 2 or 3 more episodes. When did you really get the sense that this story had so much more than just 1 hour of content or one episode anyway?
I guess it was when I interviewed the family, and there was some very, I don't know the right word to use, but it was strange for me that, you know, Barbara's siblings were not aware of some of the details that I had heard from other places, you know, and we've learned more of that along the way. So there was this sense of Mrs. Cotton either not sharing all the information with her kids or just simply trying to protect them, right? Like, it's not necessarily something suspicious, but, you know, I had more and more questions as things came along. And then, you know, after episode 3 came out, Williston PD reached out to me, you know, 4 times in one day, I think, 2 emails and 2 calls, and they wanted to be involved. And that's when I got the interview with Williston PD, which is episode 6, and that opened up even more information. So I'm not sure exactly when I realized it, but and another contributing factor was the way the community has really, the community of Williston has really, you know, come out. And, you know, my Facebook group grew from, I think, 550 members to 2,600 in a couple, 3 weeks. You know, mostly people in the Williston area. And, you know, and now we have 3 persons of interest, basically. And, you know, my interview with Williston PD, they told us about one. So the next episode will be about one of these persons of interest. And then I know I'm going to do an episode leading into the 40th anniversary, which is April 11th. And then at least one, I don't know how many more episodes after that. Thinking about possibly doing a kind of panel episode where different 4 or 5 people get to discuss the case and their thoughts on it. So,
yeah. Sandy, I'm curious, are you on that Facebook page?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What's it like after all these years to have this dedication of interest to this project? And okay, it's one thing to be active on a Facebook page, but are people talking about this at, you know, at the corner of, you know, Main and First or in Recreation Park?
Yeah. It's been the talk of the town, and it's a double-edged sword because I've wanted to hear all these things for so long. But then when you hear them and you think about, like, I've gotten not only through the Facebook page, but personally people have reached out to me on Messenger or personally called my phone and sent me rumors that they've heard or tips that supposedly were given to the FBI or different scenarios of what happened to her that night. And I'll remember when I got the first one, I think I hadn't even listened to the podcast yet. I was at work, and I got a message saying that Barb had been raped and murdered and put in a basement and covered up when they poured the foundation. And I about broke down at work, and I was like, you know, I don't want to hear this, but yes, I do. I want to hear every last thing, because who knows which little bit of information will be that one that leads to finding her. So that has been a double-edged sword. And then, like, I've teased James, like, he's broke my phone. I swear sometimes it's smoking because of all the people reaching out to me. I have to restart my phone all the time now.
Wow. Did you anticipate this, James, when you started this podcast?
Oh, absolutely not. No. You know, I did not. It's been a pretty big surprise. I mean, it's been great, actually, as far as, you know, feeling the support. I keep waiting for the haters to arrive, you know, in the whole climate we've had in this country for so many years now. You know, I'm waiting for the people to show up on the Facebook group or elsewhere and say, you know, there's always there's always strong criticism, right? And, you know, this week, twice during these however many weeks now, I've told people through Facebook that, you know, I'm wiped out. I need to step away for a few days. And ordinarily, you know, content providers are not given that kind of slack, right? But these, you know, like, they don't care. Well, we want more, you know, usually. Mm-hmm. But the support on this group has been incredible. They're like, you know, commenting in the take some time, rest up. You know, we're eager to hear the next thing, but, you know, you take care of yourself. And so I guess the big surprise for me is it's been a while since I've seen a group, you know, obviously this group is like any other slice of Americana, diverse political opinions and all that, but there's none of that going on in this group so far. And that's been the surprise to me, is that it's been a while since I felt some kind of just, turns out, doesn't matter what your political opinions are, but people want to find out what happened to a 15-year-old girl who went missing 40 years ago.
We're visiting with James Wallner. He is the creator and host of the Dakota Spotlight podcast. Season 5 centers on the 40-year-old mystery surrounding the disappearance of 15-year-old Barbara Louise Cotton, who was last seen in April 1981 in Williston. We're also visiting with childhood friend of Barbara's, Sandy Evanson. And James, you talk about, you know, telling this Facebook group that you need a break, but you're also mentioning that in the podcast. There's sort of this, you know, Wizard of Oz peeking behind the curtain of how things work in this podcast production, where you say, like, okay, we're going to take a break. We want to digest this. And you're talking about how frustrated you are that certain leads, you know, go nowhere, as is always the case in a murder mystery or in any kind of mystery. Why did you want to include that sort of peek behind the curtains aspect?
I'm not exactly sure, but I am aware that at some point along the process, I don't even think it was in episode one, I stopped saying I want to find out. And at some point I started saying we. I kind of feel like myself, even though I'm the one behind the microphone, I do feel like it's this, you know, group, a big group of people who want answers. And it sort of didn't feel right to exclude them from the behind the scenes stuff, I guess, you know.
That peek behind the curtain has been how I've felt. Is like I'm getting a peek, you know, talking to James so much or whatever and stuff. I'll want more of a peek behind the curtain because I know he's got things in his head that I don't know yet, or ways that he found them and stuff. And he's enlightened us a little bit into that, but there's no way unless we were really there 24/7. Like, how did you find that librarian? Which I thought was great. Or how did you... Like now on the Facebook page, he's saying that he found the suicide note. And these are things that we have been like waiting for so long. I feel like I'm in Oz now finally and getting some of these answers. And I'm looking to that guy back there and want to know how he's doing it.
Well, I wonder, James, has the Williston PD talked to you at all about just the differences in detective work, the major advances that have happened between 1981 and now? You have the advantage, James, of having the ability to reach out to lots of people very easily on social media. And now, of course, the police have lots of advances in DNA. Have you guys talked about just how this change in technology might help the case?
Detective Hendricks at Williston PD did state that she thought it was, you know, a great platform, a podcast, and they were excited about the opportunity to reach, you know, a lot more people. For example, you know, they have these three persons of interest, and through the podcast, I'm able to tell listeners, you know, this is what Williston PD would like to learn more about this individual, and so on. Regarding their advancement in technology, we haven't had a lot of discussion. Maybe that because there's no crime scene that I'm aware of.
Sure.
You know, was the whole forensic thing. When you don't even know if she's, you know, like Sandy says, I don't think she's alive either, but there's no body, there's no anything. And, you know, obviously detective work has changed a lot since 1981. But we haven't had a lot of discussions about it, actually.
Do you ever kind of wonder about being, you know, like the armchair quarterback, the Monday morning quarterback of detective work here? Like, you're doing a lot of cool things, James, but, I mean, is it actual police work?
Well, I don't know. I guess you'd have to ask. I said, after my interview with Williston PD, I said, you know, they want to learn more about, they named these three persons of interest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one interesting thing to know would be, can anyone place Frank De La Pena, who is one of these persons of interest, with mm-hmm. Barbara Cotton or the other one? Mm-hmm. So I asked Williston PD, well, if you have a mugshot of him, I can get that picture out to thousands of people. And who knows, you know, it's a long shot. Maybe someone will say, you know what, I remember that guy. And they were going to look for a photo. They never sent me a photo. So I called to Colorado, where he was arrested, made an open records request, got the photo from them, and posted it on, you know, the Facebook page. To me, that's, I don't know if you'd call it police work, but it's administration around getting the word out. So,
yeah. Well, it's fascinating to me, James, how much of your life has become teaching yourself these incredible skill sets that most people have to go to school for a pretty long time for, between, you know, creative writing, storytelling, and journalism, and the ethics of certain types of journalism, and then also this police work, too. Have you always been that kind of, I'm just a curious guy and I'm going to turn over this rock just to see what's under it kind of mindset?
I think so. And without getting too personal about my personal life, I'll just say that if a person has been in an environment where they didn't feel like they were getting straight answers a lot in their lifetime, you kind of adopt an innate sense of understanding when there's something missing from the story, or maybe you're being lied to, or so I've basically spent my life trying to put pieces of a puzzle together. And I've always just been very curious, and, you know, I like crossing my T's and dotting my I's, getting the full story. I often joke, I don't know if it's a joke, that I'm a pretty literal person, and I think I can be kind of a pain to some friend, you know, just in social situations where I might get a little too bogged down on the wording sometimes, even if you're just sitting around having a beer, people trying to have a good time. I'm like, wait, well, what did you say? What does that mean? So, yeah, probably always been this way.
James, just to talk about just briefly sort of the business of podcasting, there is so much. There are dozens, probably hundreds of hours that you have put in to researching and writing, and the production values on this are really quite high.
Thank you.
Are you able to make money doing this podcast kind of on your own? I mean, I know you have the partnership with Forum Communications now, or what's kind of your goal of doing this from a business perspective?
Well, from a business perspective, it's not really to make money. I mean, I was overjoyed when I was able to quit my day job. So I have a background in IT. I was a web and database developer, or still am, really. But so I moved from the IT industry, and Forum Communications has me under their belt now. So I am able to do this full time. And for me, that is sort of the reward. I mean, as you probably know, Ashley, journalism doesn't pay as well as IT, but it's more, this is very rewarding for me. And I don't have any huge goals as far as a business. I mean, there's, I don't know how many thousand true crime podcasts there are out there. I sometimes I say it's almost become a cliche, and I don't know how much longer I'll be doing it, to be honest. I mean, I'm kind of a type of person that takes on different projects and adventures. So, you know, obviously, like anyone, I'd like to reach a bigger audience, of course. But I don't have any huge long-term goals set. You know, this, I'm just very happy with this story about Barbara Cotton. You know, I said at season two about the double homicide down in Zealand in 1976, I thought, huh, I wonder if anything will top this sort of as being personally rewarding for me. And this one is definitely there with Barbara. This has just been a very rewarding ride for me personally also.
Sandy, when you hear something like that where you know how much effort James had put into a podcast like this and doing it without hope of, you know, large financial contributions, and I just wonder, how do you feel about this interest in Barbara, and maybe more importantly, what do you think Barbara's reaction would be to this kind of community coming together and still thinking about her?
I think she would be overwhelmed, and I'm overwhelmed, and I'm very grateful to James that, like, he could have came in and just did one episode, and that's kind of the things that have been done so far. You know, when it came to articles in the paper, it'd be one article or something, and not really like a continuing series of asking questions and getting answers them, either writing it off or keeping it on the books or and going on to the next lead. And he just, I keep thinking, when's he going to be done? And I'm going to be really sad when he's done, but he's not done. And I joke about it. You're never going to be done. And pretty soon there's a book coming. But he just keeps finding more information and more information. It just blows my mind.
Sandy, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
James, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me back. Appreciate it, Ashley.
That was Dakota Spotlight podcast creator and host James Woolner and Barbara Cotton's childhood friend, Sandy Evanson. You can listen to the podcast at dakotaspotlight.com. On Sunday, family and friends will mark the anniversary of the disappearance at Williston's Recreation Park from 2 to 6 p.m.
From the moment you wake up through the chaos of your busy morning, Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Through all you have to do, we'll bring you all you need to know on Morning Edition from NPR News.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.